We have two segments on the podcast today. Now, most of us are either in the age group or spend time with someone in the age group who could have a heart attack. So we wanted to do a segment on pre-hospital treatment of a suspected heart attack. The second segment is on oxygen absorbers. We've had some questions on them in the private Facebook group, and many of us will be putting up food for the future, and some may be wanting to know more about oxygen absorbers. By the way, our item of the day is oxygen absorbers, and you'll find them at practicalprepping.info/featured. Play it, Krista.
Hey, welcome to Practical Prepping. Today is March 28th, 2024, and this is episode 459. This is the Prepping Podcast with no bunkers and no zombies and no alien invasions, just practical prepping, where we believe that stuff happens, so we need to stay prepared. And so that's why we're here, to help you get prepared. I'm Krista.
And I'm Mark. And if you'd like the expanded notes for today's episode, go to practicalprepping.info/459. Now, if you're new to prepping, or even if you've been prepping for a little while, go to practicalprepping.info and click on free PDF, and you'll receive the free 12-page Getting Started in Prepping PDF, and you'll be added to the newsletter. Now, let's get into our first segment.
Segment one, we're going to talk about the pre-hospital treatment of a suspected heart attack. You know, I'm telling you, a medical issue can happen anywhere. A lot of you enjoy hiking and hunting, fishing, camping, a lot of other outdoor activities. And some of these activities can take you very far away from a hospital emergency room. In other words, it could take a long time for an ambulance to get to someone. And so we wanted to cover pre-hospital care for chest pain when professional medical assistance is not available or might be delayed, or even if EMS is right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. First thing we want to do is assess the patient. Check the patient's level of consciousness, their breathing, and their pulse. What symptoms are present? And if the patient has no pulse, start CPR.
Yeah, we've talked about CPR training, and we definitely want to highlight that.
Yes,
sure.
If you're not certified, if you don't know how to do CPR, please go learn CPR.
Red Cross can offer that, or local fire departments.
Fire department can tell you where to get it if they don't offer it. Let's discuss some of the possible symptoms of a heart attack so that we will know what we're looking at.
Well, let me tell you that not all of these signs will be present in every patient. You know, I've heard for years that men's symptoms differ from women's symptoms.
They really
can. So it's really good to know both.
Mm-hmm.
And this patient may only have one or possibly several of these signs present, but here's some of the ones that are the most common. Chest pain or discomfort or pressure in the chest described as a pushing, a pressure, a tightness, not necessarily a pain, but it could be painful. A sense of squeezing or a pain in the center of the chest that kind of comes and goes. That's one symptom. It could last for a few minutes or it may persist for longer periods of time. And this is often considered the classic symptom of a heart attack.
Next would be pain or discomfort in other areas of the body. Mm. Besides chest discomfort, pain or discomfort may occur in one or both arms, in the back, the neck, the jaw, the stomach, and it often radiates down the left arm, but not always.
It can, but not necessarily. You're right. Mm-hmm. Another symptom would be shortness of breath, that feeling breathless or having difficulty breathing, feeling like you can't draw enough air. That can occur with or without that chest discomfort.
And this can also happen when they're sedentary, if they're just sitting. This doesn't have to be on exertion. If they're sitting there and they start having a heart attack, if they go short of breath, that can be a very telling symptom as well. They might have nausea or vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
And some people do experience that.
More women have explained that that's a symptom that they'll feel is more of a stomach upset when in fact it's a heart issue.
I worked as a paramedic for a long time, and I've actually had people throw up on me.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were going into the hospital, and one guy threw up in my boot.
Well, I mean, he couldn't help it.
Yeah. Now, he had several other signs and symptoms.
Right.
But he had the nausea, and it's not uncommon, not at all.
Also, profuse sweating, often described as breaking out in a cold sweat. Well, let me ask you, Mark, is this something that also can happen when you're at rest? You know,
yes.
Like you're not necessarily exerting and sweating. You're just all of a sudden you're breaking out in a cold sweat, and that can occur with or without that chest discomfort.
It's called diaphoresis. And it can look like you poured a bucket of water on them.
When they say profuse.
That's exactly what they meant.
Oh.
That's exactly what they mean. They can also have dizziness or lightheadedness. They're feeling faint, dizzy, or lightheaded. Any of those can occur.
An unusual amount of fatigue or weakness, especially if it's an onset that's very sudden, or if that fatigue or weakness seems to be extreme, can sometimes be a symptom of a heart attack.
It doesn't mean that any of these symptoms is definitely a heart attack.
Oh, exactly.
But taken together, get help.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to do that. The idea that we originally had was if you're out a long way away from the hospital. But this really comes in handy while you're waiting. Like if we dial 911 in the U.S. and you probably have in your country have a 3-digit code you can dial for emergency. If we call for medical help here, it's still going to take a few minutes for them to get here.
And they're just a few blocks away.
Yes, it's not that far. There's some things that we can do if we have the capability to do that. And that's take what vital signs that we can and record those with the time.
Oh, I see.
Now, if you're out in the woods, if you're off someplace, if you're with someone out in the yard even, you may not have the ability to take their blood pressure. But you can take and record their pulse. You can do that at the wrist or the neck.
Mm-hmm.
You can record their respirations. You can watch the chest rise and fall.
Sure.
Don't stand there with your clock looking straight in the face. They're going to ask you, what are you doing? Just kind of notice what the time is and keep an eye on them. And you do that for 15 seconds and multiply that times 4, and you have what the...
A minute's worth.
You have a minute's worth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you count 20 pulse in 15 seconds, then your pulse rate is around 80.
Yeah.
25 would be around 100.
Right.
Now, if it's extremely irregular, you need to take it for 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
You really do, because it can be very irregular, and that multiplication method does not work well with that. Again, take the BP, the blood pressure, if you have that capability, and record that with the time. Now, if you suspect a heart attack, notify EMS as soon as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, in any emergency, whatever the medical or emergency is, if it requires fire, police, or ambulance, go ahead and get them called first and then take action, because you don't want to be starting to do something and then wait 10 minutes and then call for 911 or the emergency because you've wasted some valuable time. So always get that done first and then jump into action.
Yeah, or if you have someone else there with you, designate them to make the calls, and you go ahead and start doing what you need to be doing.
You know, something you could do if someone's having an event like that, you can ask them about their medical history, and specifically, do they have any history of heart problems, any cardiovascular issues? Are they on medication for that? Have they had any history of chest pain or chest pressure? You know, you're just trying to gauge, you know, what's happening, and is this person in a likely position to be having that heart attack?
That, and it's not that we're being so nosy.
No.
Not that it's going to make a lot of difference on what we're able to do in a pre-hospital setting, but if this is not a family member that you know their medical history well, that person could decline and go unconscious even, and you have that information to be able to give to EMS.
Oh, see, that's very important.
So it's something, it'll mean something to them because they have some things to play with that we don't normally have.
Exactly.
And so we want that information to be able to do that. You can position the patient in whatever is a comfortable position, whether it's sitting or whether it's lying down, and it's okay to provide some water for them if they want something to drink.
Now, this next part of our topic is interesting to me, and I really want you to dive deep into this, and that is administering medications if available. And you've got some ideas here that are pretty cool.
A lot of folks that chronically have chest pain may be prescribed nitroglycerin.
Yeah, I think they call that angina.
And yeah. Exactly. And it's chest pain. And that nitroglycerin is a vasodilator, and so it helps relieve that pain by moving more blood through the heart.
Gotcha.
But there's something that has come about in the last few years, maybe the last 10 years, that's really, really working and shows a lot of promise. And this is something that we want to do. If someone's having chest pain, we want to give them 2 81-milligram aspirin, baby aspirin.
Actual aspirin.
Actual aspirin. Mm-hmm. This is not Tylenol. This is not ibuprofen.
Right.
You want 2 81-milligram aspirin. Or if you don't have 81 milligram, give them 1 aspirin, whether it's 250 or 325 milligram, if that's what you have. But record what you do give them, even if it's helping them with their own medication. Write that down, because you can repeat the nitroglycerin, but only so many times, and it's kind of iffy if you can't monitor the blood pressure.
Right.
But we want to immediately give them the aspirin. And the typical dosage of the aspirin that's administered in the context of a suspected heart attack is from 160 to 325 milligram. So 281 milligram, you're giving them 162 milligrams. If you're giving them if you have a 250, you could even give them 2. It's not going to hurt them from a cardiac aspect.
Or 1.5, you know,
something
if you
like that.
A little bit more careful.
But with a 325, you just give them 1, and and you've got it there. If they chew it or they crush it, it absorbs very quickly. This dose is often given as soon as possible after the symptoms of a heart attack are recognized. Now, on the rescue units and in some ambulances in some areas, they don't have a full paramedic. Some of them, and I know of one in this county, that often runs and has no emergency medical technician. They are fire personnel with first responder training. Normally, an EMT, a basic, cannot administer any type of medication. However, they can now administer 2 types of medication. 1 is aspirin. The dispatcher in the emergency center will direct them or direct someone to give them 2 aspirin. If you call from home right now and say, I'm having chest pain, they're going to instruct you to give me aspirin. And then they're going to tell the rescue unit that aspirin is on board, is what they're really going to say. But it means they've administered aspirin. And they can administer Narcan. So that's the 2 that are cleared for anybody there to be able to do that. And they will give that aspirin ASAP, because getting it in is so important. And here's why we want to give that patient aspirin as soon as possible. 1, it has become the standard of care for chest pain.
Interesting.
It's often one of the first medications given. My first cousin had a heart attack where he had chest pain. Okay. It did turn out to be a heart attack. But at that point, all they knew was that he had chest pain. They hadn't even gotten him in a bed, and they gave him 2 81-milligram aspirin.
Wow. Okay.
And he said, then I knew something was up when they came back in there about 20 minutes later and gave me a whole full-size aspirin.
Yeah.
It has a rapid onset of action.
Okay. Does it have to be crushed in order to?
Well, you either crush it ahead of time or just chew it up, let it dissolve in your mouth, whatever. You don't want to just swallow it as a whole aspirin.
Because it would take longer.
A little bit longer.
Gotcha.
Exactly. So you want it crushed or chewed up. Now, it has well-established benefits in reducing mortality and morbidity. that are associated with acute coronary syndromes.
Well, of course, my question then is, why is aspirin this miracle take action drug? What exactly does aspirin do?
Well, it inhibits the action of the platelets in the blood, and that is the mechanism that is involved in blood clotting.
I see.
So some folks say it is a blood thinner. What it does is, and I guess that's somewhat...
I mean, that seems like the action it takes, but it's... You're saying that it keeps the platelets from clotting together.
Exactly.
So it keeps the blood moving.
Exactly. And I bleed a little bit more, and it takes a little longer to stop my bleeding because I take 81 milligrams of aspirin every day.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a little bit of an issue,
okay.
But the benefit far outweighs the downside to that. But it helps prevent further clot formation. And it reduces the risk of worsening the blockage.
Well, in the reading that I've done here, I've seen that it can also help reduce the size of a blood clot. So you're saying aspirin can actually get to a blood clot and start working on it.
It can start working on it. It's not going to totally dissolve the clot, but it will keep it from getting bigger.
Oh, see. Okay.
That's the real point of it.
I gotcha.
And it can reduce the damage to the heart. It helps reduce that size of the clot, and it minimizes the extent of the heart muscle that's damaged during a heart attack.
Oh, that's very important.
And it potentially improves the patient's outcome, and it can reduce complications.
Okay. Well, so go aspirin.
It really is a wonderful drug.
It is a miracle drug, that's
and,
for sure.
You know, it was something else when it came out. And I carry 6 aspirin in my little Altoids, the mini Altoids pill box. So I have one for stomach medications and I have one for pain relief.
Okay.
And in my pain relief one, there's 6 aspirin. It's not that I'm going to take a lot of them, but it's there for chest pain, whether it's mine or someone else's.
Well, now, this is a very important aspect of aspirin use. There have been numerous clinical trials and studies that have demonstrated the effectiveness of aspirin in reducing the risk of adverse cardiovascular events. So I think that helps put a lot of minds to rest on laypersons, for example, not being doctors or medical personnel. Knowing that, you know, someone's presenting with classic symptoms of a heart attack and it's perfectly all right to give them some of that, what they call it, baby aspirin or the regular aspirin. It's an ideal choice also for emergency situation like a suspected heart attack. Now, it may not be suitable for everyone. Now, you've really got to find out if someone already has a bleeding disorder or if they have allergies. And some people do have allergies to aspirin. You're going to want to know those things ahead of time.
We want to continue monitoring vital signs. Monitor those vital signs, including the pulse, the breathing rate, and the blood pressure, if possible, every 10 minutes or so. Several things that gives the hospital, when they get there, more data to work with. But if you begin to see drastic changes in those vital signs, you kind of get a heads up on what might be happening. If that heart rate begins to slow down a lot, or that heart rate begins to increase drastically, you might be looking at getting ready to have to do CPR.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It could happen. Not guaranteed to happen, but it gives you a clue. If their respirations greatly increase or become very labored, the doctors are going to want to know, when did that occur?
Yeah.
And how was the patient before that, and how did they react after that?
Now, I know in the midst of someone having an emergency, whether it's you yourself or you're next to someone, I know this is hard, but you've got to really take the mindset of keeping them calm, and you've got yourself to remain calm. A lot of times someone who's having a medical emergency is going to take their cues from you.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to chill. You've got to just keep a cool head, reassure them help is on the way. Try to calm any anxieties. That has actually been shown to help alleviate some of that chest pain and that anxiety. And keep someone from going into full-on panic mode, because that's not going to help.
Yeah, this is not the time to be screaming and hollering and stuff like that. You've got to keep yourself calm.
Just keep yourself
calm.
Keep the main thing the main thing.
Reassure the patient. This is where you definitely, and I know we've already said that you need to do this, but I'm going to put it in again. Activate the EMS service, the emergency medical service, if you haven't already. Now, if you're out hiking or something, you might need a satellite phone. You might have a cell phone, but somebody may have to run up to the top of the hill to be able to get help. But whatever communication device you have or can use, call for that emergency medical assistance and provide the exact location and details about the patient's condition.
Yes, because you want to inform the EMS of the progress. You know, if you've got communication possible with EMS, do provide those updates on the patient's condition and any changes in their status. I know it sounds like you're laying a lot on somebody, but just record the signs, help them as much as possible, and record the times that you gave them any medication or if any of their signs changed.
And if you're on with a dispatcher, they're going to stay on there with you until professional help arrives. Mm-hmm. And they'll ask you from time to time, how are they doing? What are you seeing?
Tell
now?
Me what you're seeing. Tell me what you're
exactly.
Hearing.
So they want that information. And they may give you information as far as instructions of what to do. And follow those instructions provided by the EMS personnel.
Mm-hmm.
When they get there, they're likely going to provide further medical interventions, such as IVs, EKGs, and medications that most of us don't have access to.
Certainly.
And then they're going to transport that patient for definitive care. Here's a takeaway. If you don't have aspirin at home or in your bag, make it happen.
This should be in your everyday carry. That should be in your get-home bag, your bug-out bag, anything that you carry and have on you, but particularly your everyday carry. You may need it or somebody else may need it.
Yeah. IEDC mine in my left front pocket. I mean, it's that close because I can leave my EDC bag at a desk and walk away from that. So that's the takeaway. Aspirin is too cheap not to have it available. I mean, it's been around 100-something years. Mm-hmm. It's generic, and so it's very, very inexpensive. And I think one time we bought a bottle of 250 for like $1.50. Now that's probably $3 by now.
But it's going to vary depending on where you are, of course.
But it's relatively cheap, and you don't have to buy that big of a bottle.
No.
And by the way, things like BC powder, Standback, those have a lot of powdered aspirin in them. Most of them are powdered aspirin with some caffeine. And that will absorb if you don't have tablets of aspirin and you have BC or Standback, use that. That will work as well.
Good call.
All right, let's go to segment number two, oxygen absorbers.
You know what these are. These are those little packets that work by containing iron powder, salt, and a moisture-absorbing agent like a small amount of clay, so that when they're exposed to oxygen, the iron in that absorber will react with it, and that forms iron oxide, which is rust. And that effectively removes oxygen from the surrounding atmosphere inside the packaging, and we're specifically referencing food. So that process will create a low oxygen environment. That helps prevent oxidation and spoilage. It also will kill insects and larva. So that moisture-absorbing agent helps to control the moisture levels, and that further inhibits microbial growth and deterioration of the food that you're trying to store. And we talk about storing for a longer period of time, months, possibly years. We're talking about long-term storage, not the things that you're going to have in your everyday pantry.
No, I wouldn't even bother with this if you're going to use it up within a year.
Yeah.
But this can cause food to last for years or even decades. If we're storing, and we're going to talk about some of those in a minute, but we're talking about food items that are stored in airtight containers such as Mylar bags or food-grade buckets, and it prevents oxygen exposure and moisture infiltration. So it works a little bit as a dehumidifier so to speak.
I see.
Cuts out some of the moisture.
But it won't do any good to use them if air can get into the container. So you definitely want it to be airtight.
And you want to store your food in a cool, dry, dark environment, which can help prolong its shelf life.
So here are some common food storage items that are stored using oxygen absorbers. Number one, and probably the most popular, would be grains. A lot of preppers will frequently store bulk quantities of grains. A lot of times that's going to be rice or wheat berries, oats, quinoa, barley, and corn. Because those grains are rich in carbohydrates and they do provide essential nutrients for long-term sustenance.
Another thing that's very, very common is dried beans and legumes, like black beans, kidney beans, lentils, chickpeas, which I love. Split peas are excellent source of protein and fiber and essential minerals. And they're staple foods in many preppers' food storage plan.
Absolutely. Now, here's my favorite, pasta. I love pasta.
As she does.
I do love it.
And again, you do not have to do this if you're going to use it up within a year or even a little bit longer.
But see, now with oxygen absorbers, it's good to know that my pasta can last year upon year upon year.
So I'm going to have to clean out more storage area. So are we going to have a pasta room?
Uh-oh.
Great idea. I'm glad you thought of it. Wink. Well, let's get back to pasta. It, in and of itself, it's very versatile and long-lasting in the dry. You can buy pasta fresh, which is refrigerated, but we're talking about dried pasta. So varieties like spaghetti and penne, macaroni, fusilli, they can be stored with oxygen absorbers for extended shelf life. Now, probably what you'd need to do is remove them from the box that they come in and put them in an airtight type of a container.
Yeah, Mylar bag.
Absolutely.
Something like that. You could even do it with a food saver.
And make sure you label it and date it, too, mm-hmm. because you will forget what it's in there and when you put it in there.
Now, you can also do dry fruits such as raisins, apricots, dates, figs, cranberries. Those are nutritious snacks that provide natural sweetness and energy. But now they must be dried first. Then they can be stored with oxygen absorbers to prevent spoilage and maintain freshness. They must be dried first.
Well, same idea here with dried vegetables. You know, a lot of folks with dehydrators, this is what comes in for that.
Mm-hmm.
Dry vegetables such as carrots and onions, bell peppers, tomatoes, mushrooms. Dried vegetables are also versatile ingredients, and you can use them in soups and stews and other recipes.
Powdered milk is a convenient and long-lasting source of calcium and vitamin D.
Absolutely.
It can be stored with oxygen absorbers for extended periods and reconstituted with water as it is needed.
Now, here's another one that a lot of preppers are excited about, and that is to remember the spices and the herbs. Dried spices and dried herbs, such as basil and oregano, thyme, cinnamon, and cumin, these are essential for adding flavor to meals. You don't want to forget your spices and your herbs when you're dealing with grid-down food because it's got to taste good.
Yeah, we don't want it all bland at that point.
And salt and sugar, too. But these can be stored with oxygen absorbers to maintain their potency and their freshness.
Now, dry mixes. You can make homemade dry mixes for pancakes or muffins or bread or other baked goods. And they typically contain flour, baking powder, and sugar and other dry ingredients, and they can be stored with oxygen absorbers for convenience.
Now, how about this one? Seeds. There's been a lot of talk about heirloom seeds and, mm-hmm. and keeping seed storages as well for future use. Some preppers actually store a variety of seeds for sprouting or for their gardening purposes, and that would include wheatgrass, alfalfa, mung beans, radishes, and broccoli seeds. Oxygen absorbers helps to preserve the viability of those seeds for the future planting. I mean, some people are 5 to 8 years out
with
their seed storage.
Oh, yes. While oxygen absorbers are generally safe for long-term storage of sugar and salt, they're not really necessary, and there's a few considerations that we need to keep in mind,
Okay. Particularly
sugar. It can help extend the shelf life of the sugar by preventing it from hardening due to moisture absorption. Now, sugar itself does not spoil, so oxygen absorbers may be unnecessary unless you're storing it in a very humid environment.
Oh, so know your climate.
Know your climate.
And your home or wherever you're keeping your food. Okay, and salt, let's talk about that for a second. Salt is a natural preservative, and it doesn't typically require oxygen absorbers for long-term storage. However, note this. If the salt has been iodized, prolonged exposure to oxygen absorbers can lead to a decrease in that iodine content over time.
So it's something to keep aware of.
Okay.
With what foods are oxygen absorbers not recommended?
There are some foods for which oxygen absorbers are not recommended, and that's because they have a high moisture content naturally. That will affect the quality, texture, or flavor of the food. So certain types of cured meats, oxygen is necessary for the curing process of certain meats like salami or pepperoni, and also soft cheeses. Soft cheeses would be in the nature of like cream cheese, goat cheese, farmer's cheese. These are soft cheeses that don't hold a stiff appearance. Mm-hmm. And so oxygen would affect badly the texture and flavor of a soft cheese. Also, do not put an oxygen absorber in for fresh fruits and vegetables for the obvious reasons. When they're fresh, they're filled with moisture, and that's why they're fresh. So we don't want to get them all pruny.
And they need that oxygen for ripening.
Exactly. And to maintain that freshness.
So once they are ripe, then you can dry them and store them with oxygen absorbers.
And think of other foods that have a high moisture content, something like, obviously, berries, strawberries, blueberries, or melons. I mean, you would do that to a watermelon because those have extremely high moisture content, and an oxygen absorber would actually destroy that.
You know, I'm wondering if you dehydrated a watermelon, would it fit in your pocket? Because those things are about 98% water.
Oh, you're talking about the whole melon? Well, I expect if you dehydrated a watermelon slice, it would turn out looking something like a, I don't know, like a
strawberry.
It's smaller than that. Anyway, back to the foods. Any foods also that have an oil content, oxygen absorbers can actually cause those oils to become rancid. And I'm thinking that that's probably true of nuts. A lot of nuts have a high oil content. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to do that because that's going to destroy the flavor and the texture of that food.
Yeah, you don't want to crack them open 10 years from now and they're all rancid, especially if you're depending on them. How do we choose the correct size of oxygen absorbers? I've seen these things in a number of different sizes. So how do we do that? How do we choose what is the right oxygen absorber to use?
Well, for small jars, which would be up to a half a liter or half a quart, 50 cc oxygen absorber is perfectly fine. That's ideal for storing spices and herbs or very small quantities of grains.
Yeah, we'll put these on the website in the show notes as well, so you don't worry about trying to write it down right now. You can pull it off of there.
And I'm not going to go through this whole list here, but I will say that like jumping to the large containers, anywhere from a 2 to a 5 quart, you're looking at a 200 cc oxygen mm-hmm. absorber. And let's jump over here to one of those food grade buckets, those 5 gallon, possibly larger. You're looking at 300 to 500 cc oxygen absorbers to handle that space. Generally, a food grade bucket is going to hold 20 liters, which is 5 gallons or more in some cases. And they would require multiple oxygen absorbers to effectively remove oxygen from a container that size.
It's essential to use the appropriate size and the number of oxygen absorbers to ensure effective oxygen removal and prolong the shelf life of the stored food items. But follow the manufacturer's instructions and recommendations when using those for food storage.
Now, today's cup of coffee comes from our friend Tony.
Tony, we really do appreciate
it. Yeah, we had some good coffee today.
If you receive value from the podcast, would you help us by giving back a little? First, you can buy us a cup of coffee like Tony. Second, you can start your Amazon shopping from our website. It costs you nothing extra, but it does pay us a small commission on qualifying purchases. You'll find the links to both of those at practicalprepping.info. Both of those help us out tremendously, and we really do appreciate it.
And we're going to link the oxygen absorbers on the website as well. So definitely pick some of those up if you know that you're going to be storing food for a year or more, let's say. And as I always say, Stuff happens. You have got to stay prepared.
And we'll see you next time.